Well, welcome to this special podcast for the Leslie Riddick podcast with Dr. Philippa Whitford, MP, who is sitting resplendent somewhere on the West Coast. Is it in your house in Troon, or are you doing the road in Westminster yet?
Oh, no, it's a Friday. I'm definitely at home. Now, this is the study at home, which shows no signs of first editions or kind of colour matched books, and is just full of untidiness and lever arch files.
But what I've got to say is, unlike Nadine Dorries, it's not just a single calculator that we can see behind you.
No, this has been a working room all my years as a consultant and of course as an MP. It's not for show.
Yeah, and just to sketch that in a bit, Philip, because I mean, I'm no doubt that people realise you are a breast cancer surgeon, but that's label. I mean, what does that mean? And kind of how, you know, what's your career been that's taken you to now unexpectedly to being MP?
Well, it was very unexpectedly. I mean, when I started out as a medical student, my aim was to be a surgeon. I'd wanted to be a surgeon from I was 11, and I was about halfway through medical school before someone informed me that I couldn't be a surgeon because I was a woman. And that then started a battle that took kind of more than half of my career. I was always the only woman in any unit. I had all the kind of nonsense interviews. I mean, I remember being told at an interview that, you know, women didn't have the mental stamina for it, and, you know, monthly mood swings would be a real problem. I kind of pointed out that I'd worked for consultants with daily mood swings, surely monthly would be an improvement. I happened by chance to do my first surgical job as a junior in a breast cancer unit, and then when I went back to Belfast, where I'm from, to start my surgical training, was on the breast cancer unit. And then even when I returned to Glasgow. So that was kind of chance. And then at the end of it, the professor I was working for asked if that was what I was going to specialize in. And at the time I thought, oh, you know, that's a bit cliched. We don't have any women surgeons in Scotland, but I'm going to be a breast cancer surgeon. And then he pointed out, you know, I'm the professor, but the patients are coming here asking to see you. I think you should give it some thought. And at that time, the treatment of women with breast cancer, we didn't have breast care nurses. Most women went to sleep and had a lump removed. And I watched them wake up groping themselves, because if they had a drip and a lot of bandages, they knew they'd lost their breast. And that meant it was cancer. And I thought, well, this is one area I could really try to make a difference. And that is what then attracted me. So all my research was into breast cancer immunology. I developed the breast cancer standards for Scotland back in 2000 and was involved in setting up the networks and things, all about quality improvement and the transformation in the service we offer to breast cancer patients over my career has just been immense and was wonderful to be part of. And that was my career. And if you cut me through the middle, it would still say doctor. Rather than politician. I kind of landed here, as I'm sure you'll know, from 2014, completely by accident. And there's definitely been times when I've thought, oh my God, what was I thinking?
Yeah, I'm sure, and we might come on to that, but I just want us people to really get then what a massive jump and sort of investment of emotional belief and everything it was for you to jump from that incredibly challenging, rewarding, but sort of really important career to think that you were going to become an MP pushing for independence. I mean, there's almost no better way to illustrate how convinced and, you know, how motivated the intake of your year just after the Indy Ref really was.
Well, as you know, because we kind of met each other during that time. I mean, I was involved in Yes Troon from when it started in March 2013. I hadn't been a member of the party before the Edinburgh Agreement. I joined thinking, right, OK, I need to find out how to get involved. And actually, a lot of the things I did were more through Women for Independence, because there was that recognition that in an open debate, kind of once the men get hold of the mic, women tend not to get a word in. And also women are much more diffident about trying to ask a question in a public meeting, and it was felt that we weren't really hearing women's voices. And so I ended up, my husband being German and a little bit, you know, obsessional about measuring things, worked out that we traveled 5,500 miles in 2014 doing public meetings all over the place. And I was still working as a breast cancer surgeon, and he would pick me up and we would head off for a couple of hours to get to somewhere and either stay overnight or come back home. And by the end, in the summer, we'd made the decision not to go on holiday, but to just keep doing this. And we were doing like 4 or 5 public meetings a week at that stage running up to it. And then, of course, you know, we all went through that bereavement process on the 19th when, unfortunately, we just hadn't done it. And after kind of crying for 5 hours, and in Ayrshire, we had a wake at the town hall in Ayr. And by the end of that, we, you know, and hearing that people were joining the party, that people were kind of fired up about not giving up, you know, it was fantastic to see that change. And then I had a couple of months of people nagging me, you should stand, you need to stand. And me thinking, are you completely off your head? And it was, I mean, Alex Salmond was one of the ones tried to talk me into it at the conference that autumn. But again, it was actually a Women for Indy meeting that we had here in Troon that Jean Freeman and I were running. And, you know, we're both going, are you going to stand? No, you? No way. and yet we were up on stage going, women need to step forward and pick up the baton and speak out. And we'd over 200 women. And it obviously affected me, because literally that was a Sunday. My alarm goes at 5:45 on a Monday to get up because I've got operating theatre all day. And it had obviously been working on me, because by the time I got to the loo, I was thinking, if not me, who? You know, we all shout at the telly. We all think someone needs to go down there and, you know, tell them how it is. But none of us actually want to throw our lives up in the air to do that. And I thought, well, I'm near the end of my career. My son is grown up and away at university. I could do it. Whereas many of the people in that audience would really struggle to do it. And woke my other half up and said, you know, I hate to tell you, I'm going to have to stand. And this was literally after 2 months of people kind of bending my ear. And I went to see the convener of Troon SNP that evening to say, I've finally given in, I'm going to do it. And he said, well, that's just as well, because tomorrow's the closing date. and then obviously it was, you know, obviously it was kind of, you're on an escalator after that. And it was only then the kind of state opening of Parliament, you know, and looking at this wall of, you know, Conservative government MPs across from us. And I remember there's an interview with Gary Gibbon of Channel 4. And I mean, I'm not quite crying, but I mean, I've definitely got the quivering lip going, I used to do a useful job. What am I going to do here? And Hans had texted me when I was in the chamber, kind of, he was watching it on telly. And he said, are you okay? You've gone really pale. And I just went, OMG, what have I done? But, you know, then I knuckled down. I mean, the problem with that place is there's not that much real world experience. An awful lot of politicians who just studied politics, a predominance of lawyers, of people who have a profession. And a notable thing during the pandemic is that there's apparently only about 30 of the 650 MPs who have any science background at all. And I think that shows. So I think it is important for people to bring real world experience into politics, whether that's Westminster or Holyrood or local government. And I think you can then contribute. And that's very much what I've tried to do. I don't just, you know, thumb my nose. I try to explain, your idea is right, but actually how you're doing it's never gonna work. This is what the front line of the NHS is actually like. And that obviously has been my role over the last 6.5 years, not just trying to protect the NHS in Scotland, but to speak up for nursing and medical colleagues and patients in England as well.
And if anyone's watching, you know, proceedings in the Commons, you can see that actually the usual hubbub stops when you stand up. So there's clearly a lot of respect for your, just exactly what you say, your lived experience of the health service. But I wonder, I mean, in terms of frustration, clearly there's a lot. But it must be huge that on this massive area of health, which is pretty entirely devolved, you're in the other parliament, as it were.
I mean that is frustrating. And obviously last year, I did consider, because activists had come to me in advance of the campaign to consider whether I would try to stand for Holyrood. And I was torn, because obviously we had just been through an election to send me to Westminster. So there is a huge frustration. I would love to be in Holyrood, you know, working for Humza Yousaf. I'd love to be doing public health and focusing on well-being, which has very much been more of my interest, and certainly been an interest ever since I've been in Westminster, the kind of health in all policies approach. But equally, you know, it is important that our voices are in Westminster. It's important that, you know, when we have people in Scotland thinking about their own country, that when they watch Westminster on the telly, that they actually see, well, you know, we've got people there who can give as good as they get, who know what they're talking about, who could be contributing to a competently run country in the future. And so I think it's important that we are there. I know lots of people, I mean, I get it all the time on social media, you shouldn't be there, you should just walk out, which would mean the voice of Scotland in Westminster would be 6 Tory MPs. And we saw during Brexit, the fact that Sinn Féin don't take their seats, and obviously they stand on that mandate as abstentionists. We do not. We have never done that. But the fact that they weren't there meant that one of the communities in Northern Ireland simply wasn't really represented in the entire Brexit discussions. So that's their choice. They stood on that ticket. But the impact of that and their missing votes, which could actually have made a difference during the hung parliament, was very striking to us. We get it a lot. Why bother being there? But I think it is important, and it does give us a platform, if you like, to highlight to people in Scotland what the differences are. So if I'm doing a health debate, and you know, I often, you know, what you were saying about people listening to me, which is a great compliment in the House. You know, I will often have both Labour and Conservative members come at the end of a speech and say, that was great. I really understood what you were talking about. I got this. That's what I would want. I want them to understand. It's not just about slagging people off. And the other thing is in debates is highlighting how innovative Scotland is within our NHS, within social care, within the wellbeing framework. And kind of pointing out to people, because often people up here just take for granted the things that they get as part of our wellbeing policies, from the baby box to free personal care, that are not available elsewhere in the UK.
And that's a point, if I can say something and this is where I got to own up, I am a man who did a joint honours in law and politics. So I'm your worst nightmare, Philippa. But that must be incredibly frustrating. The fact is that we do take things for granted up here. And I know, speaking to people who are on the fence or anti-independence, who we cannot communicate the differences that exist without sounding as if we're grievance mongers.
Yep. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, the kind of, you have to be careful about whataboutery, and, you know, I mean, it's often that parts of the media will try and paint independence as about being anti-English, and it truly isn't. You know, frankly, in 2014, in all those public meetings, I had one woman on one occasion talking about the English kings. It was not, we're not talking about England or English people. We're often talking about Westminster. But what the independence campaign was about, it wasn't about England at all. It's about us. It's about our future. And, you know, we control, if you like, half of what we raise. We get back, you know, 55 to 60% of what we raise to spend on devolved competencies. And within those devolved competencies, there's a huge amount of radicalism and innovation. There's many areas where we are leading. And whether that's quality improvement or patient safety within the National Health Service, or the delivery of free prescriptions or free personal care, or the Child Smile dental health programme, all of these things where we are out in front, it's trying to get people to realize, well, maybe if we control the other half, maybe if we had the economic levers, maybe if we had full control of tax and benefits, we could also be radical and innovative there, and therefore join up into a virtuous circle to improve the lives of everybody here. And I think it's really important trying to bring that home. It isn't brought home generally within the Scottish media. Of course, it wouldn't be highlighted within the UK media. So anything good that people in Scotland get, they just assume everybody gets it. And then if it is highlighted, we just get the, oh yeah, English taxpayers pay for it. Yeah. Which is nonsense. We've made that decision with our limited budget, which we have to balance every year. We've no borrowing powers. We cannot invest to save. We can't invest in infrastructure. You know, we literally have one hand tied behind our backs. And yet here are the things, you know, from the baby box and Best Start grants, free prescriptions, free tuition to allow anyone with potential to go further in education, through to free personal care. These are the policies that we deliver out of our limited budget. And that just doesn't come over to people. So it's trying to use opportunities to get people to realize this is what we are already doing. Imagine what we could do if we had all the controls.
Philippa, I wonder, you know, when you get drawn into conversations about COVID, and clearly, you know, the deaths that happened in Scotland were far too many, and again compared to our Nordic neighbours, much larger pro rata. A lot of commentators will say, "Well, Scotland really didn't do anything all that differently." I mean, I get that thrown at me every time I'm in an interview about anything. I wonder if you get the same, and how you respond.
Well, yes, all the time. And in actual fact, if you look throughout the pandemic, Scotland mostly had a lower death rate. And certainly if you look at the cumulative deaths, Scotland had was the only one lower than us than was Northern Ireland, but Wales and England both had higher death rates per head of population. But yes, we didn't have full control. I mean, if you remember, I think one of the prime examples was the autumn of 2020. On the 21st of September, Sage advised an emergency firebreak lockdown. The next day, the First Minister banned household mixing. And she said, if I had the financial powers, I'd be going further. But furlough was already unwinding and was due to end. The Scottish and Welsh governments asked the Chancellor to extend furlough further because they wanted to take more action. And it was refused. And it was only 6 weeks later when the UK government finally started to act on the advice, then furlough was extended because it was now affecting London. We would have been able to take more action earlier, and we simply couldn't. And the problem with that is that when you can't manage your own finances, you're limited in the response that you can make. All of these other countries had complete control of their borders and complete control of their money. Simply even things like being able to set a more generous level of financial support for people who had to isolate. You know, we didn't control these things, and therefore that limited some of our response. And of course, within the UK, I mean, you remember that even the breath of saying, you know, we don't want people traveling over the border when England had much higher levels than Scotland of cases was, you know, a whole eruption. So I it alternates when I'm doing interviews between this week doing Newsnight, being asked, why are you not following Boris Johnson, who's just going to abandon isolation? So why are you always doing something different? And then at other times saying, oh, no, actually, Scotland just did everything the same. So, you know, it just flicks backwards and forwards throughout COVID within the media. And I've just kind of given up and let that wash over me.
Yeah. But I wonder if that example sort of illustrates as well, though, how health is so dependent on every other aspect of policy. I was over at a thing in Dublin this week, and there was folk there, well, obviously from Ireland and from Denmark. But Ireland, interestingly, had really front loaded its sick pay and furlough towards the lowest paid people during, you know, the beginning of the epidemic, which was actually noticed by the Nordic countries as a sort of wee bit of a, you know, very progressive move forward. But their sick pay, you know, they're practically the worst in Europe, isn't it? You know, so that kind of also a contributory factor to folk feeling they had to go out to work. So this larger well-being thing, is that this is where you want to move, isn't it? To sort of try to tackle the whole public health state of Scotland, if you like, which is, you know, a biggie, let's face it.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, the narrative we get in Westminster is as if the UK government was the only one that did furlough at all, which is just complete nonsense. In actual fact, Denmark had started to provide furlough or at least announced it before the decision at Westminster. And as you say, the sick pay at £94 a week was just laughable. So you had people who had to go out to work, because even when the £500 came in, that was still lower than what they would have made at work. So they couldn't afford that. And obviously so many people are in insecure work that, you know, they might just be threatened. Well, if you're not coming to work for 2 weeks, don't bother coming back. So we simply don't have the employment, either funding or job protection in place to deal with something like COVID. And 2 years on, none of that has been changed. And the thing is, there is no serious attempt at Westminster to genuinely level up. It's only a soundbite. And we saw them take over £1,000 a year away from families on universal credit. So, you know, poverty is the biggest single driver of ill health, but it's also the biggest single driver of almost everything else. And when we talk about health, and obviously I get asked to talk about health a lot, people then fixate on the NHS, what the structure of it is, how big it is, how long the waiting lists are. But actually, the NHS doesn't deliver health. It helps manage or cure or treat illness. And, you know, we are lucky. Sometimes we will completely cure something that someone has. Other times we will help them cope with it. We'll help them manage it for the rest of their lives. But what actually gives you good health is almost everything else. It's whether your mother was well nourished when she was pregnant with you, whether you have a good start in life, whether you have a warm, dry home, enough to eat, whether you have educational opportunities and job opportunities. And I'm part of the Health in All Policies cross-party group at Westminster. And we did a report into the 2016 welfare changes that were coming, along with the UK Faculty of Public Health. And a figure that was given during that by one of the academics was that the UK loses about 1,400 children a year before their 15th birthday as a direct result of poverty. And that's prematurity, fetal alcohol syndrome, road accidents, house fires, drugs, alcohol, suicide, everything. 1,400 children is a secondary school. Imagine if the roof of a secondary school was collapsing every single year and killing the children inside it. Would we not be doing something about it by now? And yet we're not. We're actually driving up child poverty. And we've seen since the 2012 changes, so not the crash in 2008, but 2012, we started to see a rise in child poverty, pensioner poverty, disabled poverty, and that's continuing. And I think that COVID has changed what people think is important. And, you know, we all know we need to be somewhere different by the end of this decade, both in our society and our economy. But trying to modify a speeding train that you're on is really difficult. And what COVID has given us is it brought everything to a shuddering halt. And it won't all just come back. It will require time, energy, and money to rebuild. And therefore, we actually have a choice about what it is we rebuild. Do we just drift back to the inequality that we had before? And that's very much where we're headed, you know, with tax cuts for the wealthy and for bankers, et cetera, in London, and universal credit cuts for everybody else. Or do we want to go forward to a more well-being economy, a more sustainable way of living? And what many people in Scotland don't know, and this is, again, people are unaware of the innovation, is that Scotland was the founder of the Wellbeing Economy Governments Group with Iceland and New Zealand, and works with other countries on wellbeing policies and research. And that's the framework within which we already have our aspiration to be a wellbeing economy. And I think there's a huge thirst for that way of living among people after COVID. People's priorities have changed. They've realized what's actually important in life. And it's not the size of your car or the size of your house or how much money you leave in the bank when you die. It's about the people you love. It's about what you do with your life and who you do it with. And I think that that is the clear blue water for me between the SNP and the Conservatives, between independence and being stuck under the control of the Union Parliament in Westminster.
Well, I mean, amen to that. I mean, in the meantime, though, there would be the option to raise the Scottish component of income tax to try to kind of, you know, have more money in the system and try to deal with more, put more mitigation in place, do more anti-poverty measures. I mean, where are you on that? Because this should be the next debate as we're approaching, you know, budgets and budgetary statements by Kate Forbes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the what they've done is the kind of step for higher taxpayers is not being raised with inflation. So more people will be in that higher tax bracket. But as someone who earns comfortably as an MP, I wouldn't begrudge paying more tax. I mean, if you look at people even in the highest bands where it's just over £2,000 a year, they pay more than in England. But I mean, for every child they have who maybe went to university, that's 36 grand they don't pay in fees. You know, that's already 13 years of that slightly higher tax being covered. If they have two or three children, it's more than that. If they have elderly parents, the free personal care is something they get for that. And that's only the people in the very highest tax brackets. People below the median wage, I think it's good that we have a more progressive lower tax level for them. But personally, and obviously it's a difficult balancing act for Kate, it's not a decision I'm making, but I think that there would be many people who pay at the higher level, who if we laid out more, what is it you actually get for that extra money, would be a way of convincing people that it is a fairer way to redistribute, but also for providing services. It's infinitely cheaper to pay a little bit more tax and have good schools and good hospitals and good roads and good local, strong local communities than to be going off and buying private health and private education and living in a gated community and being too afraid to walk your local streets. So to me, I very much admire the Nordic model of, you know, let's all put our money in a kitty together and buy something better for all of us.
Yeah, well, I just amen here.
Yeah, the other guy that was in this debate, who's a Danish expert, actually, in welfare, made the point in Ireland that the most inefficient health system practically, you know, well, in the developed world, certainly, but he was sort of suggesting almost on Earth, but I suspect that's too much. But the most inefficient system was the American private healthcare system in terms of how inefficient it was, how much paperwork and red tape there was surrounding it. And it's ironic because, of course, that is the thing that's always lobbed at public systems. But just to push you, Philip, on it, though, I mean, the thing about raising the Scottish element of tax would be, you know, that anybody, 50% of Scots who are wanting independence, I think, would be loath to spend to pay more tax to Boris Johnson right now, you know. But if we were paying towards an absolutely Scottish-owned part of tax that would be spent on our priorities established by this government, I think people would be a lot more willing to consider paying extra tax.
Well, I think if you look at some of the surveys and things that are done, I mean, you know, it's always difficult in a campaign, you know, and we've seen it affect other parties as well. You know, a penny on tax for whatever goes down like a lead balloon. But when you actually speak to people as individuals, and I think that's where it's important to unpack, and indeed would give an opportunity to unpack the public service provisions that are here in Scotland that don't exist anywhere else. So, you know, here's the kind of cost of these. This is what they save you. This is the extra tax you would pay. Are you comfortable with that? And actually, I think many people would be. But it is a debate going forward. What isn't right is if we end up taxing Scots more to simply mitigate because, you know, we're not getting Barnett consequentials from England. And therefore, you know, like the national, the decision about raising national insurance as a way of funding social care, particularly in England, I mean, we would get our share, but that decision is just completely wrong, because national insurance has a bigger impact on younger and less well-paid employees rather than at the top end. So, you know, to me, that was an absolute crazy decision. But because national insurance isn't devolved in any way at all, was a way of the UK government enforcing that on Scots, and yet it being mainly about the fact that there, you know, there isn't free personal care in England. And, you know, there is limited now social care provision because local authorities have been cut. I mean, our local authorities are struggling with their budgets as well. But if you look at the budget reductions in England, some of them have been eye-watering over the last decade. And we need a different approach to this. And hopefully that's something that will also come out of things like the National Care Service debate. You know, we need to work out what's important to people. Are people willing to recognize that, you know, it doesn't come from nowhere? We need to be willing to invest that money if we want that better quality of life at every age, literally, you know, from cradle to grave.
I wonder then, you know, how the SNP could start to stimulate that debate, because otherwise you're just waiting for the media to decide that one day this is a little more interesting than Boris Johnson's latest party. I mean, I would love to see billboards on the way into every city with a list of every single one of the initiatives that you've mentioned there, which is a Scottish extra. You know, you're allowed to do that as a government. You can actually take out that kind of public communication and you can push an agenda. I mean, there's been a lot of people listening to this thinking there's another big issue you could do that with as well. You know, it feels kind of quiet.
Well, I mean, obviously, from the point of view of, you know, highlighting the extra services, I mean, I totally agree. And obviously, that's very much been part of my role when I'm in Westminster, when I'm in a debate, you know, talking about social care, you know, the free personal care, the fact that then with Frank's Law, that was rolled out to people under 65, who often, you know, people with terminal illness or you know, in England can get stuck in hospital waiting to be means tested. You know, all of these things have a very human impact on them. So trying to highlight those differences and highlighting this is how we pay for them would be important. But I also think, as I say, it's part of the wider independence debate. Here's the things we control. Here's the way we do them differently. If this is something you like, here's the other half of that circle that we don't. I mean, even, you know, often thinking about the support that the Scottish government give to new businesses, whether it's Business Gateway or rates relief or whatever. But once they grow, the people they employ who are no longer on universal credit or benefits, that's a saving to the UK government. And if they start reaching a point of paying corporation tax, that goes down to the UK Treasury. So you need a virtuous circle where if you're investing in skills or business development or infrastructure, the return on that money needs to come back to your government so that you can do it again. And it's the same with things like infrastructure. Scotland's potential around renewable energy, you will know, is enormous. But we're not getting the investment in infrastructure, in interconnectors, into direct current transmission. We still have the bizarre situation of the charges from National Grid that completely penalise the areas with the greatest potential to produce energy. So we're talking about net zero and all the rest of it, but yet the Scottish renewable energy sector is being completely penalised by Westminster. And I think these are the things that we need to unpack. This is our potential in the future. We missed out on oil. You know, the oil money didn't particularly come to Scotland. We didn't benefit from that. When the oil was flowing fastest in the 80s, we had Mrs. Thatcher simply sweeping away our heavy industry and making people in Scotland unemployed. We can't afford that the next energy boom in renewable energy, in hydrogen, etc., does the same, and that we get no direct gain from it. So I think it's important to talk about these things in the current situation, but also about the need to control both the levers of the economy and our resources in the future. And you only get that with independence. Independence is critical to that. And that's why I went to Westminster, for no other reason.
Yeah. Could I ask something that you've done at Westminster, Philippa, which we've talked about in the podcast, and I think is extremely important, is unequal access to vaccines. And you've just signed a cross-party letter to Liz Truss, who notices meeting with Marcus Sefcovic today. And I hope she doesn't, she's talking about Northern Ireland, I hope she doesn't accidentally annex Donegal, given her errors that she made yesterday. But we're coming through, we are talking about coming through COVID. How important is getting the access to vaccines out to the developing world?
Oh, it's critical. I mean, I'm chair of the all-party group on vaccinations, which I set up in 2017. And we did a report, an inquiry back then, looking at how the multinational agencies that do provide routine in vaccinations, how they could change some of their policies to improve it. And spring 2020, we had all these warm words about a global response to a global crisis with the establishment of COVAX. The UK government gave over £500 million to COVAX, but they didn't give them any vaccines. And the problem simply was that the wealthy countries hoovered up all the vaccine doses in kind of advanced purchasing, which meant that COVAX, which is run by the World Health Organization, didn't get the chance to purchase vaccines and has remained dependent on donations of vaccines that wealthy countries don't need. We saw last August 600,000 doses in the UK being destroyed because they were out of date. And we've taken evidence in the coronavirus all-party group that I'm vice chair of from health ministers in the developing and low-income countries of them being literally ministers having to go to the port every day in case something has arrived and then getting donations of vaccines that are almost out of date. So they have to stop what they're doing, focus on trying to get those vaccines out as quickly as possible, and then go back to what they were doing before. I mean, that is just wasteful. It's disrespectful. And if you look at the vaccine levels in sub-Saharan Africa, it's pitiful. They don't even have full vaccination of their healthcare workers. And they don't have access to the same level of testing or the same level of PPE. So we have abandoned low-income countries. And then we're surprised that a variant like Omicron suddenly lands on our shores before Christmas, when everybody was going, oh, yes, this is going to be great. We're going to have a normal Christmas. And that just got completely wiped. And that will happen again in the future. I mean, Omicron is much more transmissible. It's hugely mutated. And therefore, the vaccines do not work, particularly AstraZeneca doesn't work on it at all. Thankfully, Pfizer and Moderna still do. And that's why they've been used for the boosters. But that can happen to us again. I mean, that phrase, no one is safe until everyone is safe, is absolutely true. We should have taken a proper global approach, as was discussed in spring 2020, and we failed. And the thing I find most depressing about that is that that doesn't bode very well for our approach to climate change, where we also need to take a global approach. It's the global north that created the pollution in the first place. We are demanding that countries that are just growing their economy now make changes and leap forward. Well, they're only going to be able to do that if we support them to do that. You know, we made the dirt, we made the problem, and we've a responsibility for it. And it has to be done on a global basis. So the thing I find depressing is the fact that we failed to work together on such an obvious and acute challenge as COVID. And I mean, that has continued throughout the last 2 years. And at the moment, the UK has literally delivered 100% of what it has promised. And that was promised last June. And even that was a fairly low level. So this isn't changing. We're still not delivering. And the other thing that we're doing is we're not allowing these countries to produce the COVID vaccines themselves. There are many plants across the global south that could easily be producing COVID vaccines, but the UK is one of the countries blocking a waiver on intellectual property protection that would allow patents to be set aside, allow intellectual property, technological know-how and data to be transferred, so that we literally had every part of the globe producing as much vaccine as possible to try and get through this pandemic together. So it's been an utter failure of the international community, and particularly the wealthy nations.
Philippa, just to sort of come to draw to a close, that whole scenario is incredibly depressing. And yet, you know, every day Scottish voters are watching just, you know, unprecedented in our lifetimes levels of deceit, of bungling, to put it mildly, corruption. What's your answer when people say, why are we, if you like, stuck at 50% for independence? Because you would think everything we've seen in the last 5 years, 2 years, this month, last week, would be getting people screaming towards wanting to have an alternative here.
Well, it certainly has made me much more desperate to get out of Westminster as quickly as possible. I mean, of all times not to have a prime minister who is a charlatan and a liar would be in a global crisis like a pandemic. And, you know, as you know, I've stepped back from my health brief so I can focus on my Europe brief more completely, because I didn't have the bandwidth to do the two. But I mean, I've been banging my head on the brick wall that was Matt Hancock and then became Sajid Javid for 2 years and getting absolutely nowhere. Now, why that isn't changing or hasn't changed significantly, the levels for independent support, I think that it's because it's latent at the moment. And I think that is, if we were out and people say, oh, why are we not having a big campaign? Individual people are more focused on, will their job survive COVID? Will their mother survive COVID? They're not actually ready to look forward yet. And I think what many in the movement forget is that the people we're trying to speak to are soft no and soft yes voters, not the people who already are utterly convinced. And those are the people who are often impatient. No one can be more impatient than me. If they were to speak to me on a Monday morning on my way to Westminster, they'd be in no doubt about how quickly I want out of that place. But if we make a wrong move at this stage, then actually we would scare people away. We need to be reaching out. And as I often say when I'm doing, events, there's nothing to stop people following the Margot MacDonald approach. We've still been in touch with our friends, our neighbours, our colleagues who maybe voted no, not because they hate Scotland or don't believe in Scotland or, you know, they're absolute loyalists, but because they weren't convinced, because they're unsure, because they're nervous. They voted for the status quo. Well, frankly, after Brexit, the status quo doesn't exist anymore. So all of us could be reaching out in that one-to-one way to understand why someone in our family or someone among our friends didn't have the belief and faith in their own country, its resources and its people to go forward. And COVID wouldn't have stopped that. So it's not that you need an enormous public or political campaign at this point. That's not what ordinary members of the public are ready for. But as COVID comes under control, people will want to think, how do we rebuild from COVID? How do we rebuild after the pandemic? And that brings me back to this vision of a well-being economy, of being fairer, of looking at the physical, mental, economic, social, and environmental well-being of every single person who lives in Scotland, and making that our aim as we recover and as we go through this decade that is so critical to fighting the climate crisis. That is only going to be possible with independence. If we are still stuck under Westminster control, then inequality will increase, poverty will increase, and Scotland's resources will end up in the Treasury in London. And so to me, these conversations should already be happening. And that potential, I think we'll see a big uplift when people start to spin their attention back to, right, COVID is gradually fading. What do I want to happen now? What kind of Scotland do I want to live in?
Just, I mean, that those timescales that you've just looked at over the next decade and so on, I can feel a lot of little hearts sinking here in the sense that that doesn't sound like we're going for any kind of independence referendum next year.
No, I didn't mean that at all. When I talk about next decade, I'm meaning more to do with the climate crisis.
Yes.
If we are not in a different place in 2030, and I mean having brought about change by 2030, I don't mean independence by 2030, then we will be getting beyond a point of no return. No, I mean, I know the party's aim, and certainly the aim will be, there will be papers coming out in the coming months on the work that's been being done behind the scenes and to move to a more campaigning basis. But what I'm saying is, people didn't need to wait for that over the last 2 years.
No,
they will
Philip,
have been
I've
having Zoom conversations or cups of tea in their garden. So they could still be talking to friends and family.
I mean, personally speaking, I speak to all. So, I mean, I'm off to Fort William next week. Yes, Lough Haber have relaunched themselves. There was a Zoom last night, now Scotland's East Coast branch. There's all sorts of stuff happening at grassroots level. The National Organisation of Yes Groups, you know, is kind of active. There's lots of stuff happening. I would just have to sort of say, people just feel they need to get some sense that the leadership is going to be there soon to kind of have some shape of a campaign or some prospect of it, because it's kind of eroding people's faith and trust with one another. And then everybody starts having a go at each other when they don't feel that we're moving forward in a way they can trust.
Well, I'm already doing these meetings as well. I did a meeting for Now Scotland a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, I'm being asked by Yes Groups and SNP branches and so on. So I'm already been doing that and obviously been doing that when asked throughout the pandemic. I think it's important when people say, oh, you've done nothing about it for 5 years. You know, in 2015, we just had a referendum and we were elected to go to Westminster, not to get another referendum, because we just had one. When the Brexit vote happened and then the Scottish government put forward their proposal of Scotland's place in Europe, when that was chucked out, the First Minister called for a referendum and a Section 30 Act. Theresa May countered with a snap election where we lost 40% of our MPs. You cannot use that as a mandate to demand a referendum. That didn't change until we won the 2019 election and we won 48 of the 59 seats. The following month, the First Minister again demanded a Section 30 and a move to a referendum. And then COVID hit. So this idea that we've been sitting on our hands doing nothing is just nonsense. We couldn't have had the referendum during COVID. People would not have been interested. Mm-hmm. And in actual fact, the First Minister got support higher than it had ever been, simply by people trusting what she was doing and saying on the pandemic without her ever mentioning the word independence. So it's important to remember who our audience is. Who is it that we need to open their minds to the fact that Scotland could be a normal independent country that actually has amazing natural resources and fantastic people, and that therefore to believe the only way to control your future, to take it out of the hands of charlatans like Boris Johnson and Rees-Mogg, is to be in control of your future. And that means independence, like the vast majority of other countries on this planet. And that is something that we need to focus on, talking to the people we need to convince, and remembering how everything we do looks to them. So that campaigning will increase through this year with a view to a referendum next year, if COVID goes on in the right direction, which we hope. But the idea that somehow there was some magical missed opportunity in the last 5 years, if you actually look at the timeline, no, there wasn't. So we need to campaign on independence when people are ready to listen to us. And when that isn't possible, all of us need to use our personal connections to listen to one person. Why did they vote no? Would they still vote no now? Has Brexit changed their view? What's important to them? Can we reach out and talk about one thing they really care about that we could do better if we were actually in control of our resources and our future?
Right. Well, thank you, Philippa. That was a tour de force, as it always is. All power to your elbow and to that next Monday morning feeling, which I'm sure you'll overcome, as you have done all the ones before this. And we look forward to campaigning soon in a kind of sunny summer. Thanks very much indeed.
You take care, Leslie. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.